It's time for another edition of the Terry's Talking Podcast. We're back. David Campbell, your host, sports manager at Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. And joining me, as he does every week, Mr. Terry Pluto, award-winning columnist from The Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. How you doing, Terry?
I am well. I'm just glad I'm not coaching in the NBA.
All right, we got a lot to talk about on today's podcast. I guess we'll start with the NBA, and then we'll get into the Guardians a little bit. The Browns pulled off a surprising trade last week. We'll talk about that. And we've got kind of an interesting Hey Terry question that kind of came out of the blue that I was kind of surprised to see. So we'll get into that too. But yeah, Terry, not a good week to be an NBA coach. Doc Rivers was let go by the 76ers today. He joins, boy, what, Nick Nurse and Mike Budenholzer and Monty Williams. And I'm getting emails, and I'm sure you are too, basically along the lines of these coaches were working for much more accomplished teams than the Cavs, and the Cavs kept their guy and these teams didn't. And are the Cavs getting left behind? Are you seeing that too? And I guess, what do you think about all this?
Well, the interesting thing is three of those names you mentioned have been coach of the year in the last 5 years. Nurse was coach of the year. Monty Williams was, and Bud was from Milwaukee. And so Mike Brown better be worried, because he was the coach of the year this year. It seems like that. And I think Steve Kerr was the other one. Kerr's probably the one of the few people in the NBA that's really safe, along with Greg Popovich. But the rest of these guys can go. I mean, to me, I just find it preposterous a couple of these guys are fired, especially Monty Williams is really a good coach. You know, they got a brand new owner there, and they traded half their draft picks into eternity for Kevin Durant and some other things. And so now he's going to go look for a coach. And then here's the interesting thing is several of these teams that are looking for coaches will turn around and just hire these guys that got fired.
Oh, absolutely. Musical chairs, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's
in
like
all sports.
Okay. Well, you know, my guy wasn't that good, but maybe Monty Williams can do what he did a couple of years ago here. I'm glad the Cavs aren't falling into that. And, you know, we'll see what JB is. We'll see what we're talking about at this time next year. But he's been growing this team here. And I know we're in a time that people don't like patience or any of that stuff. But, you know, you bring in another coach at this point. You know, maybe, like I said, I like Monty Williams. Perhaps if he came in here, would he be an upgrade on JB? Maybe, probably, but he would also have to get to know the players, all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. I just want to see what they do in a second year of playoff things, you know, with them.
Yeah. And Terry, you know, like I'm thinking back to like high school biology class when they used to have like the life cycle of a fruit fly and stuff. There's like a life cycle to coaches, right? And they get the job, there's either success and then failure, and then things have to change, and then they either stay for a long time or they're let go, or they start out poorly and they grow things and things get better, and then they reach a plateau, and then if they can't get over the plateau, they get let go or they get to stay for a long time. And you look at the Browns, like Kevin Stefanski, right? Coach of the year, playoff appearance, beating the Steelers, and now things have kind of taken a little bit of a downward turn. They're like, all right, bring in new coaches. We're going to revamp this thing and get it going. Mm-hmm. Like JB at this point is like in the very first stage. Like he's in the growth stage, and there was a little bit of a downturn, but you've talked about this, Terry. You win 51 games in the NBA. That's very hard to do. And like, I don't think JB is far enough along in his career, and especially his Cavs career, to where fans should be calling for him to be gone just because of what's going on around the league, right?
Well, coaches will tell you coaching in the NBA is a little like they keep raising the hoop on you. By that, I mean, okay, so you right now the goal is to, say, take over a bad team like Cleveland. You want to be respectable. So now that hoop's like at 8 or 9 feet. Okay, then it's like you want to have a winning record. Okay, now it's up to 10 feet. And then you want to make the playoffs. Now it's up to about 11 and a half feet. And then you better not just win a round, but a couple of rounds. And the next thing you know, you're trying to shoot the ball over the terminal tower. And that's how it, because when you get to that point where it's championship or bust, that's about what it is. And they'll say, well, this guy, he grew stale or what. But the last time I did some research on it, the average NBA coach was with his team for a little less than 3 years. So it isn't as if they just let these guys coach there for 10 years and then, you know, oh, yeah, his voice could wear out. Because I saw that. For example, I remember when Lenny Wilkins was here. I believe he was here for 6 years. And Lenny resigned really pretty much before they were going to let him go. And he told me, he goes, you reach a point, you know, that especially if you have the same core group of players, maybe a different voice is needed. So because at that point he was with that same group with Larry Nance and Brad Doherty and Mark Price and Craig Elo, a couple of others. So Hot Rod Williams. So that was a thing. They're like Mike Fratello, the same thing kind of happened with him in Atlanta. He started knocking out 51 seasons with Dominique Wilkins, but he couldn't get through the second round. And so, okay, let's try. And then the funny thing was this. Fratello comes here. Lenny Wilkins went to Atlanta. How about that? So that's the kind of stuff you do. And I'm not, I don't think, you know, Lenny Wilkins had some real success there. I don't think he really was coaching in any way differently down in Atlanta. And I doubt that Fratello had changed the whole outcome into Cleveland. It's just the nature of it. But I just really wish people would just relax on this thing and see what JB does. I just also want to stress that, you know, what do you think, Dave? What percentage of NBA coaching is X's and O's in game stuff?
Well, are you including, I mean, there's the X's and O's stuff, but Terry, there's also like managing the personalities on the roster, right?
That's a whole other deal. No, simply, yeah. I'm asking simply so the strategy.
Simply X's and O's, I would say like 15%.
Yeah, it's, right? Exactly. I mean, you can get a lot of guys who maybe are better perhaps at X's and O's than JV Bickerstaff, but if you don't have control of your team, respect to the teammates and that, is interesting. I was at a doctor's office today, and his son works in the visiting clubhouse with the Lakers, and he was telling me how when JB and those guys came in there, how they, you know, they interacted with each other, how they were, you know, basically they acted like professionals, kind of like what you've seen. We don't have, the Cavs are not running around with guns that we know of or doing these crazy things that you see on some of these other teams. And granted, Kobe Altman has been very careful about what type of people he's bringing in here, but still the coach needs to have control. And JB does that. Even when it was falling apart with the Knicks, you didn't see a whole lot of fingers pointed in different directions or that kind of stuff. So I look at a lot of those things. It's just like you look at part of what makes – I mean, I don't know if Terry Francona is the greatest in-game manager going, but he's the greatest manager because of the ability to handle the big picture stuff, handle people, all that kind of thing. And I think JB has a lot of that. Now, his act may wear off in a couple more years, and that's how it goes, especially if he's with the same players. But for now, you've got to give him – I mean, he basically – it's kind of like a three-act play in my mind, and he just got through the first act.
Yeah, for sure. And like you were talking about the hoop moving up and down, like the hoop is going from 8.5 feet to 9.5 feet next season, Terry, right? Like that's
– Oh, I think it's closer to 11. I really do.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm saying it's hard to make those shots. And because people are going to want at least one round in the playoffs. And then here's the other thing that's going to be hard to coach is the fun part is building the team. You get these young guys in there. You're starting with a really bad record and kind of some bad stuff going on. You quote unquote get the culture in place. Then you start to get to around a 500 record. Then you get a winning record and you get into the playoffs. That's all fun because it gives, by the way, tremendous weight to the regular season when you're doing all that. Now, the whole thing with the Cavs and with many of these things is, well, you know, it really doesn't matter till you get the playoffs. And I saw that whole growth stage when I covered the Cavs when Lenny Wilkins was here, when they came in and coming in after the Ted Stepien era and, they had one kind of playoff team a couple of years before that, but it was a total rebuild. And then it was like, not only did they make the playoffs, that's like, can you get past Michael Jordan? And that was really frustrating. The nice thing I like about the NFL and I'm not a huge football fan compared to the others, is there's tremendous value in the regular season. There really is. And yeah, you wait kind of for the playoffs some, but boy, that regular season means a lot. You know, even when Bernie and that, you weren't just sitting there in week six of the NFL season going, I wonder if the Browns could get by Denver. You know, right. You really weren't doing that. But, you know, in week, you know, game 35 of the NBA season, it's like, boy, I wonder if these guys could actually win a playoff series. So that'll be what, and the players hear that stuff too. So that'll be a challenge for JB.
Well, Terry, I wanted to get your opinion real quick on something. I'm not comparing this guy to Michael Jordan, but this Victor Wembanyama, who's going to be the main attraction in tonight's draft lottery. Have you seen him play? And I guess Jimmy Watkins, our colleague, he did a good post that if you have time to check it out on cleveland.com. He basically broke down five teams in the East that the Cavs should cheer against getting the number one pick tonight. But to me, Terry, you remember Ralph Sampson back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. Like just the way he this guy's built like Ralph Sampson, but he's got handle and he can shoot it from three. And he's really something. I haven't really seen anybody like him ever.
I haven't either. I'll be curious to see how it works on him physically, just because he's so tall and thin. See, Sampson played 4 years at Virginia. By the way, when they recruited Sampson to Virginia, I don't know if this is one of those like folk tales or the real thing, but they brought him in by helicopter. I had another coach tell me he was recruiting against him. And I guess they had this big banner on top of the Virginia Coliseum, wherever they were playing with Jim back then, said Ralph's House. So, and also, I believe Sampson was from Virginia, so it was kind of keep him home and that. But the thing about Sampson is he never was sure. And I'm talking about a Hall of Fame player here on top of it. What kind of player he wanted to be? I did see him. Like, do I want to be a defensive guy? You know, he could handle it. He could shoot it. Now, we weren't in the three-point era like Victor will be. And maybe Sampson, had he played there, he would have been one of those. Forget, you know, the stretch four. He would have stretched six at 7'4" shooting those things.
Yep.
But, you know, he never won really big. I mean, he won a lot of games. But he was an odd player. Now, I don't know if that's going to be with Victor, but I'm just giving you that historic perspective. The other thing that I do think is going to be a challenge for Victor is coming in just at his age. And, you know, those tall guys with their bodies, keeping him healthy over the length of an NBA season, that will be interesting to watch. But skill-wise, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, and that's tonight, NBA draft lottery. And, boy, talk about a franchise-changing moment for a lot of teams tonight. So, Terry, you had a really good idea about dropping some of our Hey Terry questions in during the course of when we're talking about a team. So I wanted to throw this one. It's kind of a bigger picture look at the Cavs. It's from Brian Kirkendall, and he says, "Hey Terry, everyone is disappointed in the Cavs finish, and understandably. Do you think Dan Gilbert gets enough credit for his ownership time? He's had a blank checkbook for a long time and has built what seems to be a strong front office. Even when LeBron was here, they had good leadership. You just don't hear a lot of negative things about the Cavs and how they operate over the past 15 years. Cavs games are great to go to. The experience at the arena is fantastic. This was all done under his watch and with a lot of his money." What do you think of that, Terry, in terms of the credit that Dan Gilbert gets or doesn't get?
It's fascinating to watch his growth as an owner. Because I remember when he bought the Cavs, I forgot what season it was. It was LeBron's second season in the league. And Jim Paxson was a GM. He bought the Cavs, and the next day he wanted to fire Paul Silas, the coach. I mean, the next day, Paxson talked him out of it for about 6 weeks, but towards the end of that season, he did fire Silas and promoted Brendan Malone, because at that point, now this is how where he was. Remember, Dan's from Detroit. He loved the Pistons. Brendan Malone was one of the assistants on the Bad Boys. So he thought, this would be great. We'll get Malone in there. And then he takes over. Well, then in the offseason, he did hire Danny Ferry and Mike Brown. And he gave him 5 years, which was pretty good. So that was a that time, though, kind of Danny Ferry, he didn't rehire Danny Ferry. And then Mike Brown won 61 games, by the way, that year. That was LeBron's last year. LeBron left. Mike got fired. And then you went through a lot of the waiting for LeBron to come back or whatever, the tough LeBron rebuild. I remember he fired Chris Grant in the middle of the season, put in David Griffin. That was an interesting move that nobody saw coming. And then that was also when they brought back Mike Brown. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So they had Byron Scott for a couple of years, and they bring back Mike Brown. It was really odd. And then they went through, the coaches with LeBron's kind of half running the franchise with them. But here's where I think Dan's actually been at his best. Now, he spent a lot of money and all those things, and he had to sell LeBron on coming back. He did. But this time around with Kobe Altman, and Kobe was going through the coaches there. Remember, Kobe Altman inherited Ty Lue. And then after LeBron left, he had Lue the next year who told him he wanted to coach a young team. Lue did not, even though he said so. After six games, they fired him. By the way, their first six games, not only did they lose all six, they only led in the second half once. I mean, it was really bad. And that's when all the stories were out about Colin Sexton and the veterans and all kinds of junk like that. So then Larry Drew took the team for the rest of the year. Drew, at that point, didn't like the whole situation. He says, I'm out of here. So he leaves. And then John Beilein comes in. And they go through that. So now in the rebuild, in the first year and a half of the rebuild, they go from Ty Lue to Larry Drew to John Beilein. And they're losing. And I'm going, oh, this is bad. And I'm sure Dan had to be going through some tough times. Now, also at this point in Dan's life is Dan had a major stroke. And so that probably in some ways helped everybody put a few things in perspective. Dan was going to be more patient because he was going through his physical stuff getting back. And Kobe was given a chance to get one more coach in that year and to what really helped Kobe, and this is something rarely heard, John Beilein walked in the middle of his first year, resigned, and I think he had like a 3 or 4 year contract. I think he just took the salary for the rest of that year, and that was it. He really hated the NBA. And interestingly, if you notice, he hasn't coached since. He's helped out a few places. I think he's like an advisor to the Pistons now. Then JB came in, and I remember I think he went 6-5 or something like that. Then COVID shut down the Cavs. The next year, they had a rough year. I think they were like 22-50. And I wondered if everybody's going to get fired again. I think the old Dan Gilbert would have done it. But he gave Kobe one more year with JB. And that was they turn around and they draft Mobley. They trade for that with Jared Allen when he picked up. They drafted Mobley. He made the marketing trade. That all happened right there, and then suddenly now they're on the way back to the playoffs. See, this is where actually patience showed and Dan's growth as an owner showed. So I agree. The game presentation is terrific. They will spend. I mean, he doesn't want to go into the luxury tax, to win 35 games. That he doesn't want that. But, if Kobe comes up with him something now and we want to do this, Dan will green light it.
Well, and he always has. I mean, if they think the payoff is there, he goes over the tax. And boy, we were talking about Ted Stepien last couple of weeks, Terry, compared to Cleveland owners of the past, to have the stability and the deep pockets and just the long-term security that Dan Gilbert has provided, in addition to everything else he's done. I think.
And one of the ways to get out of a mess is to have patience with the general manager. And I'm speaking now, you mentioned when Stepien left. Then they had Gordon Gunn bought the team. He inherited Harry Weltman, who wasn't his guy. And then he let go of Weltman and he brought in Wayne Embry. And he was patient with Embry and Wilkins as they rebuilt that. Fans thought, well, they didn't win the title. I mean, those are wonderful years here. And because they won 50 games, I think, three times and made the playoffs and the Jordan stuff and made basketball relevant. And this same thing paid off. Dan decided Kobe was his guy. And he let Kobe go through a few coaches. And he was going to stick with them. And it's paid off. And if you look at the roster, Kobe's fingerprints are all over good moves on this roster. And then you turn around, you look at what Markkanen did when he went to Utah. Markkanen's stock was like, one of these tech companies that suddenly fell way out of favor when he brought him in here. And Markkanen began to reinvent himself here. And, of course, he goes to Utah where they feature him in the offense. And he averaged like 24 points a game. So, and Markkanen was used to bring in Donovan Mitchell. So that was it's fascinating to see that. So I'm on board with who was it that that wrote that wonderful letter?
Yeah, Brian Kirkendall. Thanks for that, Brian.
Yep. Yeah, double thumbs up for you.
All right. Yeah, before okay. I forget to mention it, anybody who's listening, you want to send us a question, comment, just email us at sports@cleveland.com and put Terry's talking or Hey Terry in the subject line, and we'll try and get it on the next podcast. So, Hey Terry, real quick, we got to take a break here, but I told you I was going to bring a name that I wanted kind of to keep an eye on during the offseason here that they might be able to add. Mm-hmm. Chris Fedor, our colleague who covers the team, he's got some stories coming about names to watch. But one guy that's really stuck out to me that might be worth the Cavs' mid-level exception, which I think is $12.2 million, is this Grant Williams from the Celtics. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've been watching him much, but I even before I started kind of thinking of him as a Cavs fit potentially, I've just been impressed with how tough he is. And I mean, you know, you watch that 76ers series, they had him singled up on Embiid at one point.
Yeah.
Williams is 6'6", and he's leaning on Embiid and fighting and getting right up in his face. And if you look at his numbers, and you do this a lot, Terry, you kind of are always looking for progression and how guys mm-hmm. are building on that. This is his fourth year in the league. He's gone from 15 minutes a game to 18 to 24 to 26 pretty much this season. His points per game have gone from, well, let me talk about his three-point shooting first, but he shoots pretty much 39-41% from the field, and that's gotten better every year too. He's gone from 25% to 37 to 41 to 395 this past
year. These are on threes, you mean?
These are on threes, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You know, his points per game have gone from 3 to 4 to 7.8 to 8.1. His rebounds per game have all gone up. He's gotten more time. And I just, you know, he's a 78% free throw shooter. He's a restricted free agent at the end of this season. I think he's projected for an $8 million, a qualifying offer at the end of the season. But if the Cavs offered him 12, like, I don't know. I just think he's a really intriguing guy, and he kind of brings a little bit of an edge.
Yeah, he does. The problem with a restricted free agent, all you do is negotiate the contract for the Celtics.
Or somebody else.
Or somebody else. Generally the Celtics.
Right.
You know, because they'll match it, and you might be able to work a trade. Yeah, he's intriguing. Chris's guy's DiVincenzo. I know he likes him. Yeah, I was thinking about the Cavs, too. Obviously, the small forward story is there. But, you know, the other thing is they don't have a guard who could make three-point shots coming off the bench.
That's true.
Because LeVert is more of a driver and that, and of course he's a guard / forward. See, that's what really hurt them. And I know they realized there was risk with Rubio bringing him back, David, that when would he be ready to go off that second ACL? But they thought perhaps by playoff time. But Rubio's shot was totally broken last year. If they'd have had Rubio, I'm not saying they would have beat New York with the Rubio that first came here, you know, a couple of years ago. But that guy coming in at a game with the Knicks to settle things down, get the ball moving, all that, I think would have made a huge difference. Now, maybe he comes back to that player. But they need a guard who could shoot. Because, right, basically, you're starting your two guys, and then there's nobody else that comes in my mind anyway, that is even a above average outside shooter.
No, that's true.
And not even talking about three-point specialists. Just to even make a medium to 18-foot. I know they all hate the 15, 18-foot jumpers, but that you don't see those guys. And so they got to look for that guy too.
And maybe that's someone you could find in the second round of the draft, which they do have a pick. And
it, yeah, I mean, they did that last year, but it turned out he was part of the drill. Bajé. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he started towards the end of the year for Utah, and they got some minutes out of him.
Yeah, so somebody like that that you could find, mm-hmm. you know, here's your job. You stand there and you shoot threes when we get you open shots. So I don't know.
Oh, you just kind of look around to try to find someone who's ascending upward. I mean, I know this. It seems like when Kobe does stuff, they keep the lid on it, and it's a surprise move. Whether it was Larry Nance Jr. for Markkanen or the Mitchell trade, you know, those, and those are, you know, big deals around here, and there were nothing leaked out about them. So probably the rumors, they're a little like the Guardians in that regard. The rumors that you hear will probably be wrong, and the move they make will probably surprise you.
That is history. That's what we've seen. So I think you're right on that. All right, Terry, we're running a little late here. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask if you are worried about Emmanuel Clase or not, and what the numbers say about that. So we'll get right into that when we return on Terry's Talking. We're back on Terry's Talking, David Campbell and Terry Pluto. We're going to get into some baseball here. So, Terry, Emmanuel Clase has been so dominant since he's been with the Guardians, and I wanted to get your thoughts on – there's kind of two schools of thought on him. Some people are concerned about his velocity, and other people are saying, well, look at his numbers. Like, he's still getting the job done. Friday night against the Angels, I think 14 of his 27 pitches were 99 miles an hour or above. And then on Sunday – against the Angels, he came in the ninth with a 4-1 lead, gave up two runs. He threw 25 pitches, and only two of them were 99 miles an hour or above. He blew the save on Friday. He got the save on Sunday. He's 14 for 18. He's leading the big leagues.
Probably in saves and probably blowing saves too, I bet.
Yeah, and the Guardians are under 500. And so I just kind of wanted to see what you have been seeing and what you think about where he's at. Any concerns or not?
I think that his control's not as good. I'm not talking about walks, but just pitch placement. Because whether you're throwing 98.5 or 101, I mean, that's getting it up there. It just is. And he seems to be not hitting that outside corner like he was. A little bit, too, of the other things I've noticed is he needs to throw inside more. I don't mean knock him down. Just kind of break some bats and do some of that stuff. Because, you know, he isn't a guy that, like Karinchak strikes out almost two an inning. Of course, he walks guys. That's not Clase. He's around, you know, 10 strikeouts per nine innings. And so when he's getting hit, it just seems to me that he's over the heart of the plate. In the past, he would give up kind of weak ground balls, you know, that kind of stuff. He was just hard to hit. They always said I remember Francona said early on, it's like he's throwing bowling balls up there. They always call it a heavy ball. So I'm not sure why that isn't happening for him, but I do think that's really, when you talk about problems, that is it. To me, his control isn't as good. And I'm pulling up his stats now just to see if there's anything that, you know, pops just jumps out at me. I mean, in 21 innings, he's only walked five. So it's not that big. But how about this? Last year, in 72 innings, he walked 10. So let's do the numbers there. So 10 in 72 innings, and this year 5 in 21. And that doesn't count how many times he's behind in the count. So that's
– So he's on pace for almost twice as many. Twice as many if you times it by four,
exactly.
I would say.
So he is so he's given up basically they do hits per nine innings, walks per nine innings. And really even the walks per nine innings isn't that high. But it's just to me, that's one thing that I hadn't looked at this until now. And I just noticed, geez, you know, he just seems to be behind in the count and it's over the heart of the plate. So we'll have to, you know, see how that plays out. But I'm all right, I've got to give the velocity people this. He's only got 13 strikeouts in 21 innings. You know, this is a guy that basically averaged a strikeout an inning. So that's a sign, too. Now, I don't know if he needs to use a slider more or something else, but I don't think he's hurt.
Yeah, the fact that he can still get it up to that velocity implies not. But I think you bring up a good point with the control, Terry. I mean, last year we would see him get a save, a ninth inning save in 10 pitches or 13 pitches. I mean, even in the All-Star game, I think he threw like 13 pitches against some of the best in the game. And now we're seeing 25 pitch innings and 27. I wanted to get your thoughts on this too, Terry. The pitch clock has gone from being like, oh my God, this is ruining my rhythm at the beginning of the season in spring training, to now where it's kind of people aren't talking about it as much. But the save conversion percentage in Major League Baseball has gone down from 67.8% at this point last season to 61.4%. And a lot of people are attributing it to the pitch clock, because you have 15 seconds to deliver a pitch, right? If the bases are empty and 20 seconds if there's a runner on, you're in the ninth inning. It's a high leverage situation. You're trying to make sure you're throwing the right pitch, you know, making sure you're communicating with the catchers. There's guys on base. It's a high pressure situation. And now you're adding the pitch clock, which is even more pressure. I don't know if that has anything to do with what we're seeing from Emmanuel Clase, but it was pretty striking to me. The save percentage has gone from the past decade. It was at 70%, I think, in 2015, and now it's down to 61%. So I just thought that was interesting. I don't know if it's applicable here or not, but
a couple of things on that. Number one is, when it comes to relievers and what pitch to throw, most of them only have two pitches.
True.
So let's keep that in mind. They don't have force. They're not picking from a lot. But a lot of these guys got in the bad habit of acting like they're these diva actors coming in the ninth, and they're walking around and waiting for almost like the applause and deep breaths and all this stuff. And I am not in the analytics camp of all kind of innings are sort of the same. No matter what they say, there's something totally different about the ninth inning psychologically. Paul Shuey was a guy who had a great arm and should have been a great closer. He could never handle the ninth inning. But he was great in the seventh and eighth. Bob Wickman, Joe Brokowski, you know, some of those guys that saved games, or Doug Jones even go before that, they did not have great stuff, but they could handle the ninth inning. And so this is the first time you go like, yeah, Clase's having trouble handling the pressure of the ninth inning. And so that'll be something to watch too. Now, periodically, closers just have a bad year. And then the next year they come back, and sometimes it's a setup guy, and then they end up going back in a closer role and they do well. You know, we mentioned Mariano Rivera. Well, there's a reason he's in the Hall of Fame, and a lot of these other guys aren't. But I do think some of these guys, and Clase, while he wasn't as demonstrative, he's staying out there for quite a while between pitches, throwing, figured I'm only going to throw 8 or 10 this inning. Well, that has changed. And I'd say figure it out. I really do. Just
there's a
figure it out.
Yeah, figure it out. Get all the MLB players. Yeah. All right, Terry, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the catching situation last week, and we got an email from Paul C. in Stowe, a longtime listener and fan of the show. He says, hey, Dave and Terry, why can't the Guardians find a defensive catcher who can hit? This year we have Mike Zunino, who's batting 187 and is struggling defensively, which we talked about last week. And he wants to know when you think they should bring up Bo Naylor and turn the job over to him. We kind of touched on this last week, but we're getting toward the end of May here. The weather's warming up. The ball is jumping a little bit more. What's the right timing in terms of if they do want to bring up Bo Naylor? When do you think is the right time?
Soon. If they want to do it today, I'm fine with it. And Zunino plays a couple days a week. Naylor plays a couple days a week. You start with that. By the way, I had wrote a column over the weekend. I did not realize Zunino's defensive problems the last few years. He led the league in pass balls in 2000. And now last year he did not, 22, because he was hurt. But in 21, he led the league in pass balls. And he led the league in 2019 in pass balls. 20 was that weird season with 60 games.
Right.
So, he's been having problems for a while. And also, it's kind of slightly unfair when you look up how many wild pitches allowed, but they've gone way up. At this point, he was second in the league in wild pitches allowed. And I did look at his numbers just compared to Hedges. And now Hedges can't hit at all, but Hedges also doesn't let anything get past him either. Now, right now in the league in baseball, nobody can throw anybody out. I mean, you talk about stats plummeting. These guys, I think it's like 19% is the average catcher throwing people out, and it's dropping as we go on during the season. And in the minors, Bo Naylor, last I saw, was like 5 for 46 or something. And this is a guy that in his previous minor league career, he had averaged throwing out 31%. So I'm almost throwing out stats, unless you happen to be looking at the guy and you see there's something wrong with his arm. So I'm not worried about Naylor's throwing him out. And that's why I'm not dwelling on Zanino's not throwing anybody out, but nobody is.
Right. Well, it seems when you get close to Memorial Day is the time when the Guardians tend to make kind of the big bold move when they see something that they think.
And also they look down there. Naylor's been hot the last few weeks.
Yep.
They always want to bring a guy up when he's hot. So that's always been their big thing. Now, Brian Rocchio got called up today. Jose Ramirez went on the bereavement list. So I don't know exactly who it was that he lost that was close to him. So Rocchio comes out and he is hitting 330, and so we'll see how he goes. And I just wanted to kind of check to see what Oscar Gonzalez is doing. He is 8.
Start out hot, I know that.
Yeah, he's 8 for 30, a homer, a couple of doubles. So we'll sort of see what happens with him. I know that they want. He's stolen three bases. Is that right? Stolen three bases. Oscar on the run. So there you are. No, my eyes are getting bad. That was a guy named Delgado in front of him. But he is hitting 267 with a homer and six RBIs. Rocchio's coming up. He's hitting 338. He's stolen 10 bases, hasn't been caught yet. 21 strikeouts, 15 walks, OPS 833. He is a very good shortstop. He's got 13 doubles, 3 triples, and then you asked about Naylor. Naylor is at 256, and he's got 9 home runs, 32 RBIs. By the way, Columbus is a nice park to hit in for power. That's why people say, you know, talking about Zach Collins, who's hitting 331, 8 homers. Zach Collins has been around. He's 28 years old, and there's, in my mind, maybe they'll call him up, but I see nothing there that intrigues me at all. But I'd rather see Naylor play, certainly, than a lot of Cam Gallagher.
All right, well, we'll see if they make that move. We got one more question here, Terry, about the Guardians. This one's from Ed Cohen, and Ed says, "Hey, Terry, it's absurd how feeble the Guardians' offense is right now. I know it's likely to improve, but even Terry Francona has acknowledged that it's hard to win with just singles and speed. It puts too much pressure on the pitching staff. What do you think are the chances the team trades some of its wealth of starting pitching for an infusion of legitimate home run hitters?"
Well, if to find one, but they also have a bunch of middle infielders that people like too. Mm-hmm. They have stuff to trade. So it's just a matter of them finding it. And then it has to be a guy that's under team control for a couple of years or under a contract that they want. They don't want just a rental for the rest of the year or something like that.
Yeah. There's a formula and a profile, and it has to fit that profile.
I will say this in the past though, Antone has been willing to trade prospects. He loves to trade for them. But I remember, like, when they made the Adam Miller deal, they traded Gary Sheffield and an outfielder that Clint Frazier, that was who it was, two of their top picks. And so they moved him. And I remember when they traded, this is when Chris first got the job, and they brought in Ubaldo Jimenez, and they traded two of their former number one picks who were pitchers. White was a pitcher and is a big left-hander whose name is, he went to Mississippi. His name escapes me at the moment. So he's been willing to trade for his first round picks for guys. So that's a good point. He could do something like that if he could find somebody that they like. The nice thing is I thought this weekend, it's not just because Naylor was hitting the ball. The other guy started to hit. Finally, Jimenez started to hit. Jimenez is a very important, but they gave this guy $104 million. You know, they think he's got a chance not to be Jose Ramirez now, but the Jose Ramirez who hit around 300 with 15 homers to 20 homers, you know, before Jose took that next step. They think that's who they have. Now, he's still playing a tremendous second base. I'll tell you this, like, I saw Paul Hazy, Paul Hoynsey had him, what, he's gotten hit by pitches seven times already?
Yeah.
This is bad. I'm serious. You're going to mess your career up. You know, the ball is hard. It hurts. It breaks bones.
Well, and he got so, hit in the wrist the other day and was able
get
to get
out
it
of the so, way.
Yeah. Sometimes it's not worth it. So,
but it was nice to see. You know, it's amazing. You come to the middle of May and it's like now Rosario shows up. He gets three hits a game.
Yep.
He does it. He did it with the Mets. He does it every year. And as Francona will tell you, you'll look up at the end of the year and he'll be hitting 282 again with, you know, his numbers are so, you know, the old, the numbers on the back of the baseball card. And I'll ask you this, David, what do you think of Josh Bell?
Oh, I mean, that's the thing about this question we just got is like, guys have a history of being power hitters, but then when you bring them in, like, what are you going to get, right? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Josh Bell has been a disappointment. There's no other way to say it,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Huge.
I mean, we're now at 100 on the, no, more than that. Excuse me. We are now at 165 plate appearances. He's got three home runs. And this is probably something I'll look at for the weekend. You roll it back now to when he was traded to San Diego. So remember, he had a big first half plus with Washington. This is where he hit 14 homers in 103 games and was batting 301. Now, though, in the last 92 games, he has how many home runs do you think he has in the last 92 games, David? Pick a number. Pick
Six.
A number between 7 and 5.
Was I right? I said six.
Six is correct.
Oh, wow. All right.
But think about this. 375 plate appearances. This is like that kind of Oscar Gonzalez stat we had one for 27. 375 plate appearances. Six homers.
Yeah.
32 RBIs.
One
batting
one
about
210. Yep. Maybe this is what it's going to be. Maybe it's just.
And if it is. Yikes.
Yeah. All right, Terry, we got to move along here. Yes. Real quick, though, I did want to mention Zach Plesac. We can kind of track how he's doing. He started off in Columbus 1-0 with a 1.64.
No surprise.
And two earned runs in 11 innings with 12 strikeouts and 5 walks.
Yeah.
So we'll keep an eye on him as things go along. It might be he might figure in things in the long run. You never know. So
yeah.
All right, Terry, the Browns pulled off kind of a surprise. Mary Kay Cabot, our colleague, has been writing that she was expecting them to make some kind of a move to get another edge rusher. This was way bigger than I think a lot of fans were expecting.
Oh, yeah.
With Za'Darius Smith coming in a trade with the Vikings, the Browns basically in the swap got back from Minnesota 6th and 7th round, 7th round picks in 2025 in addition to Smith, and then they gave Minnesota a pair of 5th rounders in 24 and 25. Pretty surprising move. It came on a Friday night. It was kind of like a Friday night news dump, as they call it in the business. Mm-hmm. It happened late, but were you kind of a little surprised they were able to pull this quality of player in a
Yeah, it was like the Amari Cooper trade. I mean, just like that. And then you go, well, there has to be something really wrong with this guy. So I'm doing all the research now. There were the last, I think, 9 games. What did he have? Only a sack and a half, you know, after I think he had 9.5 or whatever it was. In the first half, he was playing with a bad knee.
Right. He bruised a knee on November 13th, I think, against the Bills. Right.
Nonetheless, to just pick him up for what, a 4th and a 5th? But it was sort of like with Cooper. You pick him up for whatever, that was a 5th and something else, and swap a 6th. And you're going, if he just sort of plays his average year, you got a Pro Bowl guy, or at least close to it. And you can't lose. Now, this is where fans sometimes get mad when the Browns don't always go all the way up to the salary cap and that. And Andrew Berry does like to kind of keep, he'll tell you, $10 to $15 million in his pocket for opportunities like this. And
it was a little bit of a salary cap boon for the Vikings.
Yes, same thing on Cooper.
That's why they made the deal. Exactly
Cooper
like
was in
Cooper.
trouble.
Yep.
They were in salary cap hell with Dallas. And the same thing, the last time I looked, this was right before the trade, Minnesota was less than $1 million over the cap. And I think they had some other people that need to sign. I mean, they had problems. So they were looking to do something. Smith wanted out of there. He ended up trading agents or firing agents. He wasn't happy with the contract he signed. I think he misunderstood how much was guaranteed or something. So the Browns are very opportunistic. And I'm always surprised in the NFL why more teams just don't do this. I mean, apparently there weren't much of anybody else bidding on Amari Cooper last year or Smith this year. Now, maybe Smith comes in and blows a knee. Okay, so what? I mean, that's fine. I mean, you want him to be healthy, but it's not like they turned around and traded Joe Bitonio for him. I mean,
Yeah, 2 fifth-rounders, like you said.
yeah, okay, fine. Remember fifth rounders, third to sixth rounders, only 15% of those picks ever become starters in the NFL for more than a couple of years.
Yeah, I was surprised that number one, it didn't happen before the draft, and number two, that it happened like at this point of the year. Like usually around June 1st is when
Yeah.
a lot of this happens. So yeah, it could be a win-win for both sides, as Mary Kay has been suggesting that. The Vikings get out of some salary cap trouble, and this is a good player, a veteran that the Browns can lean on.
Right,
So.
and the nice thing, and Mary Kay has written it, and I wrote it the first night because I got it from a top official there, that the Browns really see him as an inside rusher quite a bit too. I mean, I'm curious to see what the wide nine or whatever it is that Schwartz plays, that they're going to how they're going to allocate these roles. And I know there's a lot of internal stats that showed last year, and even the year before, the Browns were much better in press coverage than they were in that weird, it was called the four quarters zone that Joe Woods was playing. And if you know what it is, I'm going to defer to you to explain it. But he just kept playing the quarters
Yeah, and
coverage.
the Browns were better at man-to-man than most of the teams in the league. I don't have it in front of me, but yeah, I
Yeah.
think you're right, Terry. We're going to see a lot more man-to-man press this year. So,
I know that Schwartz says too, if you're going to do that, you've got to help your guys. He means the back end. So you got to really press, not just press coverage, but pressure the quarterback. But this is great. I mean, I'll tell you this. Look at Andrew's off season. It's been terrific.
It has. And this is reminding me a little bit. Ohio State does this thing with Larry Johnson called the Rushman package, where they basically put four pass rushers on the field on third and long. Like, who cares if they're inside or outside? We're going to put our four best pass rushers. And we're kind of getting that they could do that theoretically if they wanted to with Okoronkwo and just Miles on the left side, and off you go with
And think about, okay, if you're
Za'Darius
playing
Smith.
Joe Burrow, you're playing, well, Lamar's a little different because of his athleticism. I know they got Aaron Rodgers. They're on the schedule this year. They're playing a lot of these different guys. Fine, it's third and eight, and you rush the house on them. And if they run a draw, okay. I mean, it might get the first down, but that's better than having that guy sit back there and pick you apart because you're in your quarters coverage, where you're covering a lot of empty grass.
All right. Hey, Terry, before we move on from the Browns, I did want to talk real quickly about your Bernie Kosar column from over the weekend. And you had a long, really revealing discussion with Bernie just about what he's been going through and the things he's dealing with. Why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, Bernie reached out to me because this upcoming weekend on Saturday, at the marathon, what's marathon weekend, Saturday, 7 a.m., they're having a walk for CTE. And it's obviously something very special to him. And what he really felt compelled at this point in his life, people have known he's had a lot of concussions and that. I've written some stories on that and some others. But he said, I'm willing to really tell you what it's like. And I've never talked about this stuff. And we would go 3 or 4 days without sleeping because of the headaches and the squeezing, driving on 480 and not knowing where he is. And he said, I could name five or six, seven players that are having gone through the same thing. He goes, but they don't want to come out, and that's fine. I'm protecting their privacy. He goes, but when we get together, we tell these stories and we're embarrassed at what has happened to me. I mean, here's Bernie, who made his living being smart, in the analytical mind. And, he walks into a store, why am I here? you know, that kind of thing. He was in a coma for several days, and happened in Chicago. He also was in another minor coma. 15 months ago, he had a brain bleed. He's the good thing is he got up to 320 pounds several years ago. He's down to his playing weight at 210. He's on a real strict kind of vegetable supplement, you know, health food diet. That's helped. But still, they don't have any cure for this at all. And the side effects for several of these people include, you know, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and Lou Gehrig's disease. And from what Bernie was telling me, and I've heard this from some others, the NFL has been very, very reluctant to kind of settle with these players despite the settlement suit. They're making it very difficult for them to get the kind of medical money. And to prove that point, they were hit with a lawsuit in 2021 where they settled, where they had, I guess what, the assumption was African-American players are not as smart as white players, so therefore the cognitive ability for them was a considered a lower bar than for white players. It's preposterous.
Amazing.
And so, and they had to own up to that and change that. And this isn't a league that's what, 65 or 70% African American. So Bernie obviously feels very strongly about this. He's like, wants everybody to come out, walk with him. He said Bob Golic's supposed to be there, I think some others. And if you haven't read that story, do check it out because it's very revealing. And the point is, Bernie is not, this is not just about Bernie. And he admits that some of the mistakes financially, other things in his life, are not because of CTE. They were bad decisions on his part. He's not talking about that. He's just saying, this is where we are at our age.
Well, and Terry, the NFL has been so slow to, well, first admit that concussions mm-hmm. were a problem and that CTE was a problem. And now it's really good that the NFL players have people fighting for them to make change, because it's going to be a long process. And the sad part is a lot of these guys are getting up there and they need the money now. And the way the NFL is dragging their feet, it's taken way longer than they deserve.
And Bernie mentioned, you know, Junior Seau and a couple of the other guys that have committed suicide and some others that he said they did, and just they're kind of real marginal players. People don't know about them. And they're guys from college, not just NFL, but, you know, people have had a lot of concussions. And generally, as you said, too, people with brain trauma.
Yeah, and these guys need the money now. So they really do. So I hope.
The NFL doesn't have it. Give me a break.
Yeah, no kidding. They just got $100 million this week from Peacock to allow Peacock to show one game on streaming and not on broadcast TV. So, man, talk about money. It's flowing.
All right, I'm going to be ignorant, and I know the Guardians. What is Peacock?
Oh, it's basically NBC's streaming service, and the history that was made, it's going to be the first time that an NFL playoff game is only available on a streaming service. Yeah, it's a play by this Peacock to get people to sign up. So,
oh, boy. Because in the past, what the NFL is always smart to do is their games are basically available to everyone.
Right, right. And this is the one exception they've made, so we'll see what happens. But
good. They're going to be like the when we talked last week, MLB, where you buy their package, but you don't get your local flavor.
You never know. Well, anyway, I just hope some of this money starts going to some of the players that need it here. So, all right, Terry, we have a Hey Terry question. Again, if you want to send those to us, you can email us at sports@cleveland.com. This one is from Andy Getz from Denver, who has written us before. He says, "Hey, Dave and Terry, recently I was traveling in Bologna, Italy, and I saw a guy wearing a Golden State Warriors championship T-shirt. I did a double take when I saw what year it was, 2016. I thought, no, that's not right. The Cavs won it in 2016. This must be a T-shirt that was ready in anticipation of the Warriors winning. Now we see where these obsolete T-shirts wind up."
Yeah, he sent a picture to me of that guy, too.
Yeah, it was something.
Well, that really stinks. Like, Golden State didn't win enough titles in that span. They got to, like, try to steal the one they lost.
Can't even give Cleveland the one that they earned.
Then Cleveland wins it, and they turn around and recruit Kevin Durant to come back and beat the Cavs.
Well, thanks for that letter. You never know what you're going to see when you're out there, but I thought that was kind of fun.
Well, you were in Italy, weren't you?
I was, yeah, a couple
Did
months
you see
ago
any
for
shirts
an anniversary.
Like that?
No, I didn't.
Did
but
you
I'll
see any, like,
out.
LeBron shirts or anything?
I saw a lot of Yankees and Dodgers hats, incidentally enough. It's a fashion thing. And a lot of people wearing that stuff, but not so much NBA. So there you go. But yeah, keep an eye out for those crazy t-shirts out there. If you see anything, send them to us. We'll be sure to include them. So, all right, Terry, so we're off next week, right?
Yes. All right. Taking a few days off.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. I think we're done, right, Terry?
Anything else? We are.
All right. We'll catch you in 2 weeks. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks on Terry's Talking.